salt, it's also creating products that have the capacity to rewire our brains, driving us to seek out more and more of those products. To understand why a chocolate chip cookie seemed capable of getting its grip on me, I turned to Mathea Falco, who heads Drug Strategies, a Washington-based nonprofit that seeks effective approaches to substance drug abuse. What is it about an inanimate object on the plate that plays such a large role in our minds? I asked. Why are some of us always thinking about it? What is it about this stimulus? It's a dragon, David, she said, and the dragon is bigger than you. Jerome Kagan, a renowned developmental psychologist at Harvard, taught me that the most effective rewards are those that can change our feelings. Eating highly palatable food falls squarely in that category, stimulating the brain in ways that provide momentary pleasure. That pleasure acts as a substitute for other emotions since it occupies working memory and the brain can only focus on a limited amount of stimuli at any given time. But our behavior isn't simply driven by the pleasure we derive from highly palatable foods. These foods also possess the ability to command our attention. Sometimes that attention is warranted, given the survival value of food, and sometimes it is not, given the era of plenty in which most of us live. Living creatures survive by focusing on the most salient stimuli in their environment. If we are chased by a wild animal, caught in a house fire, or faced with an ailing child, such circumstances demand center stage on our minds, standing out from arousals of lesser power. But that response can be co-opted, and when it is, it leads us to focus on objects we would otherwise ignore. That's what happens when jelly beans gain salience. A salient cue that, against our wishes, comes to occupy our thoughts and stimulate our emotions can provoke impulsive behavior. Whether the response is mild or intense, almost everyone has some vulnerability to the conflicts and unwanted thoughts such a cue engenders. I was talking with a colleague about how the neural circuits of the brain had evolved to focus on the most salient stimuli and why this can drive us to overeat. As we talked, I deliberately tore open a box of chocolate chip cookies. He sighed and asked, "Why did you have to do that?" I had just cued him to the availability of a thick, chunky chocolate pleasure. Suddenly, his attention was diverted from our scientific discussion to an arousal he had not sought and did not want. His conditioned brain responded immediately to the sensory properties of that cookie. Salient food drives a cycle of overeating behavior. Highly rewarding food becomes reinforcing because we've learned that it makes us feel better, motivating us to return and do the work necessary to feel better again. Reinforcement learning is a mechanism for the organism to figure out which course of action will lead to positive outcomes, explained Wei-Tat Fu of the University of Illinois. Learning that a certain behavior generates reward motivates us to act, and when the motivational circuitry of our brains is activated, we come back for more. This process is enabled by the power of memory. Our memories store the experience of consuming highly palatable food and the resulting reward. This learning circuitry makes us aware of cues that predict the emotionally valued experience, so that when we sense those cues again, we also retrieve the memories associated with them. And those memories, in turn, drive arousal, so that we repeat the actions that led to pleasure. With the wide availability of potent stimuli, this process repeats itself over and over. The more multisensory the stimuli, the greater the reward, and the stronger the emotional reaction. The stronger the emotional reaction, the more potent the memories. The more potent the memories, the more powerful the cues. Action builds on response, and response generates action. Eventually, the actions that lead to pleasure become imprinted on the brain, and the habit of pursuit becomes firmly established. This is rooted in evolution. It's simply more efficient to act automatically than to devote effort to deciding whether to take action. It's quite valuable to be able to schedule things into a habit system, said UCLA researcher Bernard Balain. Once our behavior becomes automatic, The emotional component, the desire to feel better, is no longer required. We saw this principle at work in the experiments that demonstrated the power of habit. The animals persisted in eating food even after they'd been sickened by it. They acted against their better interests because they were guided by routine rather than by new learning. When our brain circuits have adapted to a predictable pattern of behavior, we find ourselves in a cycle of cue, urge, reward, habit. We repeat the same action over and over because that's what we've become accustomed to doing. Reward learning takes place, but then it becomes highly automated and below the level of conscious awareness, explained Raymond Nyura of Brown University Medical School. At that point, we are almost literally thoughtless. Wiring embedded deep within the brain's reward circuitry becomes our guide. We heed its response not only to salient food, but also to other rewards, such as sexual opportunity and psychoactive drugs. This is a region driven primarily by reflexive action, not reasoned thought. Neuroscientists think of the habits delineated in these neural pathways as bottom-up conditioning. Stimulus-response type habits are established that are largely unconscious and very hard to control, said Philip David Zelazo, a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, who studies the development of executive function in the brain. Once habits become ingrained in the lower brain, we no longer recall how or why they developed. You just notice over time, hey, when I'm in this situation, I tend to act that way. Something triggers an automatic behavior, and we respond according to our conditioning, without reflective thought or even awareness. You just get caught in these cycles where one thing leads to another, and you're just at it again, and you're not even thinking about it, said James Lechman at Yale University. And having started, it's difficult to stop. Once you've crossed the threshold, the floodgates open, according to Raymond Miltenberger, a professor in the Department of Child and Family Studies at the University of South Florida, and an expert in repetitive behavior disorders. In the process, we may become discontented with the discrepancy between the reward we expect and the reward we actually experience. In order to revive our prior level of satisfaction, we may feel driven to seek out something more novelty, more stimulation, more calories, two pieces of cake instead of one, chocolate peanut butter pie to follow buffalo wings, foods higher in sugar or fat, more variety. The ephemeral nature of the sought-after reward may drive pursuit in an increasingly feverish upward spiral. Just as a compulsive gambler can't place a single bet and feel satisfied, many people can't stop after a few bites of hyper-palatable food. We've become conditioned to seek more reward. The barricades to repetitive behavior have been toppled. We keep looking for the next big wow. That's what the industry has engineered, with food built layer upon layer to stimulate our senses. Foods high in sugar, fat, and salt, and the cues that signal them, promote more of everything, more arousal, more thoughts of food, more urge to pursue food, more dopamine-stimulated approach behavior, more consumption, more opioid-driven reward, more overeating to feel better, more delay in feeling full, more loss of control, more preoccupation with food, more habit-driven behavior, and ultimately, more and more weight gain. All of these responses are made more acute in the face of more potent stimuli and ubiquitous cues. That's what's happening in today's high-sugar, high-fat environment. Hyper-palatable foods are hyper-stimulants. And when a stimulant produces reward, we want more of it.
Chapter 28. What Weight Loss Drugs Can Teach Us.
If overeating is the result of changes in the reward, learning, and habit circuits of the brain, then drugs that act on those circuits should alter behavior and help control this impulse. That's exactly what a combination of two drugs, phentermine and fenfluramine, more commonly known as fen-phen, seem to do. Fen-phen proved to be dangerous and was pulled from the market in 1997. In some cases, it produced serious and sometimes life-threatening side effects in the heart. While no one should use this drug combination today, we can learn a lot about the biology of overeating by examining the way it worked on the brain's reward circuits. Many doctors say fen-phen was the most effective drug therapy they ever had for treating obesity. Fen-phen acted in a complex way on two brain chemicals, serotonin and dopamine. The drug combination increased the level of serotonin, which shuts down the action of dopamine and reduces activity in the reward pathways. The overall effect was to lessen the drive for reward. Research has shown that serotonin can also tamp down the rewarding value of drugs of abuse, such as cocaine. For example, a test animal that has been conditioned to press a lever to obtain cocaine will stop doing so after being given pharmaceuticals that promote serotonin release. This may help to explain reports in psychopharmacological journals that phentermine and fenfluramine reduce drug use. If the same pharmacologic therapy decreases the power that both food and drugs of abuse can gain over the body, then they are in all likelihood engaging the same regions of the brain. That means the reward circuits targeted by highly palatable food are also the reward circuits targeted by drugs. The stories physicians tell of patients who used fen-phen are remarkably similar. Over and over again, these patients reported being able to stop focusing single-mindedly on food. Everybody who has ever treated obese people and put them on fen-phen had a patient say to them, "I felt normal for the first time," said Richard Atkinson, who directs the Obatec Obesity Research Center. Atkinson described one such patient who had lost 100 pounds without the aid of drugs and then struggled by sheer force of discipline to keep that weight off. Driving past a donut shop, the man remembered the many times he would walk inside, buy a dozen donuts, and eat them all in one sitting. As his weight dropped, he would pass the same store and chant fervently to himself, "Don't go in! Don't go in!" Usually, he managed to muster enough willpower to keep going, but it took an enormous effort. All of that changed for him when he began taking fen-phen. The donuts stopped dominating his thoughts. He no longer felt hungry all the time. His overwhelming sense of urgency to pursue food was gone. Obese patients treated with fen-phen at the Nigerian Center, based in Los Osos, California, had similar experiences. At the supermarket, they bought a lot less food and they were less likely to buy junk food, said founder and director Thomas Nigerian. They were not thinking about food all day long. Food did not drive them. In general, fen-phen reduced its reward value. At the Weill Cornell Medical College in Manhattan, Louis Aroney echoed his colleagues. "What was fen-phen like clinically for patients?" I asked. "What did they tell you?" "They felt normal," explained Aroney. "Their relationship with food was normal. They would say things like, 'I'm there, the food is there, but I don't feel like eating the food. It used to be that I'd see the food and I'd go completely nuts, and that doesn't happen any longer.'" Still another confirming anecdote came from Michael Weintraub at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. Prior to using fen-phen, patients would tell him, "While I'm eating breakfast, I'm thinking about the donut I'm going to eat at 10 o'clock. And while I'm eating the donut, I think about lunch, and I think about dessert after lunch." Phentermine and fenfluramine, said Weintraub, wipe that all out. The message from clinicians was consistent. Fen-phen changed not only their patients' eating behavior, but also their perception of food. They finally felt satisfied and in control. This drug combination seemed to cut the link between the cues for rewarding food and the brain circuitry that responds to those cues.
Chapter 29. Why We Don't Just Say No.
I began to develop an overarching theory about eating for reward. Chronic exposure to highly palatable foods changes our brains, conditioning us to seek continued stimulation. Over time, a powerful drive for a combination of sugar, fat, and salt competes with our conscious capacity to say no. I've termed the resulting behavior conditioned hypereating. Conditioned because it becomes an automatic response to widely available food and its cues, hyper because the eating is excessive, driven by motivational forces we find difficult to control. Conditioned hypereating works the same way as other stimulus response disorders in which reward is involved, such as compulsive gambling and substance abuse. Such disorders are characterized by a high degree of sensitivity to sensory stimuli, and they typically lead to a perceived loss of control, an inability to feel satisfied, and obsessive thinking. I believe this is what bedevils Sarah, Andrew, Samantha, and Claudia. In order to treat conditioned hypereating, it is essential to understand the patterns of behavior associated with it. How does conditioned hypereating override the executive control functions of the healthy human brain that should allow us to say no to highly palatable food? What explains the potency of arousal? Why should a cookie be anything more than just a cookie? Three powerful and interdependent forces engage fundamental neural mechanisms that interfere with executive control: cues, priming, and emotions. These triggers amplify the beckoning power of highly palatable food and make it difficult for many people to turn away. Let's explore the reach of cues. We've learned that when a cue captures our attention, it can motivate us to act. When we're aroused by the anticipation of reward, we seek the release that changes how we feel. On my way home from the gym, I drive past an In-N-Out Burger, a popular Western U.S. chain. As I near the restaurant, I'm expecting to see it and thinking about how good a hamburger and fries would taste. At once excited by the thought and uneasy about the action, I start a silent debate with myself. Yes, today I will stop. No, I shouldn't. Yes, no, yes, no. My continued ambivalence allows me to think of nothing else. Discomfort settles over me, an anxiety of my own creation. If I pull into the restaurant, I can resolve the ambivalence and subdue the arousal. For the moment, my discomfort will disappear. But I'll be putting other forces into play. If I make that stop often enough, my response will become automatic behavior, a habit. At that point, any efforts to suppress it will only intensify the power of the cue. Expectancy is the cue that tempts me into In-N-Out Burger, but it is not the only provocateur. Cues can gain power even if we're not consciously aware of them. Seemingly out of the blue, we may begin to think about an egg and bacon sandwich, or a favorite donut, not recognizing that our desire has just been triggered by an advertisement, a memory, or a location. You're aware of the thought, but not necessarily of what drove it, said David Cavanaugh, a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia. Whatever the initial prompt, thoughts begin to build on thoughts, creating what Cavanaugh calls an elaborated thought. I might begin to think not only about how good that donut will taste, but about where I can buy it, what route I can take to get there, and how much better it will make me feel. Simultaneously, I may also be thinking that I shouldn't want it and I shouldn't eat it. All of those things start crowding in, said Cavanaugh. There's a lot of parallel stuff that's occurring when people are trying to engage in control at the same time they're experiencing a desire. Distinguishing the longing for a highly palatable food from conflicted thoughts of pursuing it becomes difficult. You're thinking about it and you're approaching it in your mind, and that feeds the affective power of the craving, says Cavanaugh. The response planning and the craving start to become very similar. The thoughts become larger and larger, I asked. You get a much more elaborate image. You're aware of taste and smell and size and sensation in your mouth. As you elaborate that and make the image more complex, it becomes effectively more powerful and more motivating. Increasingly insistent and expansive thoughts consume more mental space as we become more preoccupied. But we try to hold ourselves back. The emotional drivers of wanting struggle with the desperate desire to resist temptation. Behavior-activating messages that urge pursuit clash with internal messages demanding control. Our brains become battlegrounds. Ultimately, our decision to reach for that food, to relax our struggle for restraint, to give in to consumption, becomes the only possible relief from the anxiety of a war within. But the satisfaction doesn't last. By responding to a salient cue with action that generates immediate reward, we only strengthen the association between the cue and its reward. You have the wanting, you eat the food, you experience the reinforcement again, said Marcia Pelchat of Monell Chemical Senses Center. If you eat the salient food that you want today, it's going to be more salient tomorrow because you have more positive associations with it. You increase the number of memories that you have of the food. Soon enough, you're cued again, desire builds, and the cycle begins anew. Now consider the power of priming. Sometimes just one taste of a food, a single dose, is enough to trigger conditioned hypereating. We call that effect priming, and it's another way to kick overeating behavior into action, even when we're not hungry. That's what the food industry knows when it tells us, "Bet you can't eat just one." It's what Alcoholics Anonymous recognizes when it warns drinkers, "One drink, one drunk." A small quantity can be enough to generate a large response. Although the underlying biology of priming isn't fully understood, the same neural circuitry that responds to cues seems to be at work. A highly palatable food tells the brain, "This is a desirable object. Get more." Harriet DeWitt, in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Chicago, explained to me, "Immediately after eating that first salt and fat-rich potato chip, you want more of it than you did a minute before you had one." It's as though it's stimulating the dopamine system, the motivation and reward-seeking system, a little bit, enough to get it going to make you want more. Priming, which is lodged in the brain's fundamental motivational circuitry, has the power to make an animal seek out more of a stimulus. Adaptive in origin, it is yet another tool our species has developed in order to survive. "It makes adaptive sense for animals to get hungrier once they find a little bit of food," said DeWitt. As with our responses to cues, priming works in part by triggering memories of past pleasure and activating the reward pathways of the brain. Priming may also be something of an abstinence violation, suspects DeWitt. If somebody's been trying to abstain from cheesecake and has gone for a very long period of time before having just a little bit of it, that can lead to eating way too much of it, she says. In a sense, that person gives up and a spiral of eating follows. When we're hungry, almost any food can have a priming effect. In fact, that's one of the risks of dieting. But in the absence of hunger, only highly palatable foods are likely to spark further eating. "Having a little bit makes you want more, and then you have it, and it makes you want still more," observed DeWitt. That's when it becomes hard to stop. Martin Yeomans, at the University of Sussex in England, has done experiments in which he keeps interrupting people as they eat to ask them how hungry they are. Halfway through their meals, some people rate their hunger levels higher than before they started to eat. The power of priming is made visible in a study that looked at two highly palatable foods, pizza and ice cream. The results showed that we're motivated to seek out more of a specific stimulus when we've been primed for it. Researchers first fed lunch to 28 men, so they were presumably not hungry when the rest of the experiment took place. After their meal, the men were assigned to one of three groups: one primed with pizza, one primed with ice cream, and one that wasn't primed at all. The priming was done by placing a medium-sized mozzarella pizza in front of the first group and two big bowls of vanilla and chocolate ice cream in front of the second, and then inviting everyone to take a single bite. Immediately afterward, the men filled out a form on which they rated the sensory properties of the primed food, including its flavor, smell, and appearance. A few minutes later, both primed groups were presented with all the foods. That is, the group primed with pizza also got the two bowls of ice cream, and the group primed with ice cream also got the pizza. Everyone was then told to eat freely. People ate more of the food with which they'd been primed. Unlike cues, priming holds power for only a short time. That means the food for which you've been primed has to be readily accessible. If you eat one piece of candy and there's a bowl of them in front of you, chances are you will keep eating more. But if no more are available, or you have to search for them, the priming response may be undermined because you won't be stimulated for long enough to alter your behavior. Next, the influence of emotions. Among people who experience conditioned hypereating, emotional states often heighten the power of cues, overpower executive control, and intensify the drive to eat. It's a form of self-medication, said George Kub at the Salk Institute. You're modulating your arousal. People take the food to calm themselves down. Rajita Sinha at Yale University's School of Medicine said that sadness and anger have the greatest potential to drive a loss of control. If you've got that really charged emotional situation with both of these emotions going, chances are you'll be going to the kitchen before you know it, she said. Because a cookie makes me feel better, it's easy to develop the habit of seeking it out when I'm sad or angry. Over time, as neural pathways link the change in my mood with the experience of eating the cookie, the association grows stronger. These products have some kind of hedonic calming effect, said Kub. In other words, they relieve the itch. The problem is that the itch comes back. Anger and anxiety can act as a setting condition for cues, says Charles O'Brien, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. A cue that has been extinguished in the basal state, when the body is calm, again becomes active in producing craving and physiological changes when it's presented after a person has been put in an angry state. We see this with smokers. I can remember being in a room and there was a tense discussion and everybody would start lighting up to either increase their alertness or to calm themselves down, Kub recalled. I think the same thing happens with people who learn to eat that way. The effect is visible in imaging studies in which people undergo brain scans as they respond to cues suggesting they're about to get a milkshake. In one study, researchers first induced a negative mood by playing some dark music and asking participants to recollect a particularly depressing life experience. Afterward, the regions of the brain where the reward pathways operate showed greater activity level in response to the anticipated milkshake compared with levels among participants in a neutral mood. We interpreted those findings as suggesting that when emotional eaters are in a negative mood, the idea that they are about to get a milkshake makes them anticipate reward, said Eric Stice, a scientist at the Oregon Research Institute. That's not the case for non-emotional eaters, and it's not the case for a neutral mood state. It only emerged in a negative mood state. When emotions amplify reward, the drive for reward becomes even harder to control. Stress also lends more power to each of the mechanisms that drive overeating through its capacity to heighten our arousal. If you're in an agitated state, a stimulus will act on you more, will generate a little more vigor, said Bernard Belain. Call it the paperclip on the rat's tail phenomenon. Pinching the animal's tail with a paperclip is a mild stressor, not so strong as to interfere with the animal's behavior, but strong enough to intensify all its usual activities. There are limits to the arousing effect of stress. Profound stress, the death of a family member, for example, can interfere with this response and shut down overeating behavior. To capture the impact of mild stress, Belain suggested I visualize myself in a familiar conference room. When the tone of a meeting is relaxed, Belain said, you're looking around, recognizing cues, but they're not having any motor effects on you. Then the dynamic of the meeting changes and someone makes me angry. Suddenly a cue in the room that has signaled reward in the past takes on new power. For me, that cue is likely to be the platter of cookies sitting in the middle of the table. Under normal circumstances, I probably found its attention-grabbing effect hard enough to resist. Most likely, I was consciously willing myself not to reach for a cookie. But when stress comes into play, holding myself back becomes even harder. By intensifying my arousal and approach behavior, stress steamrolls over the cognitive voice that had been trying to say no to the cue. When you get into this slightly aroused state, the strongest cue in the environment will tend to elicit the motor response it has been associated with in the past, he said. is a level of affective arousal. Periods of transition can make us more vulnerable. Eating foods that are high in fat and sugar seems to be one way to ease the discomfort of transition emotions. These are the emotions we encounter as we change from one activity to the next. A meeting ends and we get in the car, or a television program is over and we walk into the kitchen. As our activities change, so does our state of arousal. Is there any evidence that food really makes you feel better after you've eaten? I asked Loma Flowers, a community psychiatrist in San Francisco. Absolutely, she said. People feel better after eating it. They eat for anxiety, and it soothes anxiety. It really does work like a Valium, but that effect, of course, is momentary. When we learn that a stimulus provides gratification, that knowledge drives our wanting, arousing us further. Our focus narrows to the target of our desire, capturing our full attention and directing us toward it. The anticipation of feeling better puts us in a heightened state of focus, making us want it all the more. What we fail to realize is that the food we ate for comfort has left its mark on the brain, creating a void that will need to be filled the next time we are cued. The result is a spiral of wanting.
Chapter 30. How We Become Trapped.
Cues, priming, and emotional triggers all drive conditioned hypereating in fundamentally the same way, by stimulating mental ghosts. These ghosts are representations of past sensory and emotional associations with food that we've stored in our brains. Expectations, or what Mark Goldman, associate director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, calls traces retrieved from memory, give form to these ghosts. When we expect food to give us pleasure, positive reinforcement, or relief from distress, negative reinforcement, that expectation amplifies the reward value. Expecting something to be rewarding stimulates pursuit of that reward. Expectancy has powerful effects on strengthening the primary reinforcer, George Kubbs said. With the script of how we behave in the presence of a stimulus already written and stored in our brains, expectancy also helps to control the choice we make between actions. The belief that food will make us feel better contributes to our desire for food. At that point, it's only a short step from wanting the food to feeling that we need it. The act of eating becomes something we do to attain a desired emotional effect. If most often eating alleviates my negative mood state, then over time that cognitive memory will become the salient, predominant one, said Gregory Smith of the psychology department at the University of Kentucky. Having come to associate the behavior of eating with a desired outcome, we begin to act more automatically to achieve that outcome. For example, I believe a Milky Way candy bar will make me feel better because it has done so before. That expectation drives my action. I'm caught in a cycle of craving, satisfaction, and more craving. Conditioned hypereating takes on a momentum of its own. The dominating influence of rewarding food can be marked along a continuum. Many people like and want a food, but only some of us develop elaborate thoughts about it or a preoccupation with it. We still need to dig further to understand why some people are so much more vulnerable than others. But for those unlucky ones, an increasingly intense focus on reward can spiral into obsession. Thinking about cream cakes is fine, as long as it doesn't become dysfunctional for you, David Kavanaugh said. What makes it an obsession is the fact that you don't want the thought. Someone who can't stop thinking about a cream cake when he would like nothing better than to shut it out of his mind comes to wonder, what does it mean if I have this thought? This must mean I'm a very weak person. I'm somebody who cannot succeed at a diet. The brain is conflicted. That generates unhappiness, followed, ironically, by the notion that only the cream cake can bring relief. We begin thinking, I feel so awful now, but if I actually had that cream cake, I'd feel better. The clash escalates as we try to put the cream cake out of our minds. That's known as the white bear problem. If you tell yourself not to think about white bears, soon that's your dominant thought. The research literature tells us we can suppress thoughts only for short periods of time. As soon as we tell ourselves, "I'd better make sure to avoid that thought," we start to focus on it. An attempt at suppression is going to mean that the thought becomes more salient, said Kavanaugh. Indeed, focusing single-mindedly on not eating eventually pushes us to eat more. Feeling deprived only increases the reward value of food, and then usually gives way to indulgence, and often to abandon. As desire evolves into need, we do exactly what we've tried so hard not to do. We eat that cream cake, and then we feel worse, which makes us even more likely to be out of control. To find your way out of this trap, you need to understand the functions of the brain, the drivers of conditioned hypereating, and what you can eat without triggering the reward-based behavior that leads to habit.
Chapter 31. Conditioned Hypereating Emerges.
When I first began to talk to people about the loss of control over eating, I was met with two opposite reactions. Many people understood immediately and were themselves often painfully and personally familiar with the behavior. But a smaller group, having had no direct experience with out-of-control eating, was convinced it could be halted by exercising willpower. I realized that if I was going to bring attention to conditioned hypereating as a major behavioral issue, I was going to have to define it more rigorously and identify some of its specific characteristics. I also needed scientific evidence to support my growing conviction that conditioned hypereating was correlated with becoming overweight. To get started, I mostly had a lot of questions. What features define conditioned hypereating? Who is affected? How is it linked to excess weight? Why do some people at a healthy weight also exhibit conditioned hypereating behavior? I asked three colleagues at the University of California, San Francisco, Alyssa Eppel, an expert on cognitive health psychology, Michael Acri, a biostatistician, and Tanya Adams, a psychology postdoctorate fellow, to help me answer these questions. The scientific literature gave us a good base on which to build our research. It told us that not every overweight person demonstrates the same set of eating behaviors in the presence of highly palatable food. It also reminded us that overeating is not the exclusive province of the overweight. Many people, fat and thin alike, lose control in the face of rewarding foods. But those who are obese do seem to be more susceptible to the disinhibited patterns of eating that often allow rewarding foods to gain the upper hand. A revealing study showed that obese women consumed significantly more throughout the day compared to women who were not obese. This may seem self-evident, but remember, a lot of wrong-headed ideas about why people gain weight still circulate, and it is important to understand that calories count. More revealing for my goal of understanding behavior was the finding that the obese group ate more snacks, more evening and nighttime meals, and significantly more during non-traditional mealtimes. Another trait shared by many people who are either overweight or obese is their tendency to keep eating beyond the point of hunger. This became evident in a survey that asked, "How often do you keep eating at meals even though you're not hungry anymore?" Women who reported that they eat beyond satiation nearly every day were dramatically more likely to be obese than those who rarely or never did so. Obese women were also willing to work harder for food, which is the defining trait of reinforcing behavior. In one study, two groups of women were allowed to earn points that could be traded for either high-sugar, high-fat snack foods or for access to activities such as playing video games, watching a comedy video, reading popular magazines, or playing computer solitaire. Research has shown that these forms of entertainment are highly reinforcing. One group was obese, the other was not. There were no significant differences in how much either group actually liked the rewards or in the hunger level of participants. But the obese women were consistently more likely than the non-obese women to earn points for food rather than activities, reminding us that liking and wanting are not the same thing. All of this evidence gave me a basis for investigating which eating behaviors might be associated with conditioned hypereating. Working with my colleagues, I began looking for appropriate data to analyze and eventually found it in the Reno Diet Heart Study, led by Sachiko St. Jor, a nutritionist at the University of Nevada. Launched in 1985, the Reno study had goals entirely different from what I was interested in. Its main purpose had been to assess the relationship between cardiovascular health and weight. But no one had used the data collected in that study to ask the questions that interested me. The Reno study was one of the largest, most comprehensive studies ever conducted on how people eat. Researchers had enrolled a total of 508 men and women across age groups. Half were overweight or obese, and half were not. And they'd been followed for 5 years to assess their weight, attitudes toward eating, and eating behaviors. 3 years after the first 5-year phase was completed, the researchers had been able to track down most of their original subjects to gather more information. Their data included true or false responses to statements such as, "Sometimes when I start eating, I just can't seem to stop. My stomach often seems like a bottomless pit, and I'm always hungry, so it's hard for me to stop eating before I finish the food on my plate." We also had answers to questions such as, "How often are you preoccupied with thinking about food?" Together, the information allowed us to focus on 3 behaviors of interest: loss of control over eating, lack of feeling satisfied by food, and preoccupation with food. Based on what I knew about the classic symptoms of other conditioned and driven behaviors, all 3 characteristics could reasonably be considered expressions of conditioned hypereating. We used a sophisticated statistical process called latent classification analysis to determine whether one group of people exhibited more of those characteristics. It turned out that about 1/3 of the study population scored high on at least 2 of the factors, or in a few cases, very high on one of them. But the most significant feature for me was how the figures broke down by weight. Some 50% of obese participants and 30% of overweight participants demonstrated the features of conditioned hypereating, as did 17% of those who were lean. The gender breakdown was also of interest. 56% of obese women and 43% of obese men exhibited conditioned hypereating. Those with evidence of conditioned hypereating were almost twice as likely to have been overweight early in life. The sizable minority of lean people with features of conditioned hypereating warranted a closer look. Most of them scored high on questions that measured their ability to compensate for their food drive by concerted and conscious efforts to limit their eating. As a result, they had been able to maintain a healthy body weight during the study period, but could well face challenges in maintaining such behavior over time. This population is probably at risk for weight gain. Clearly, a broad swath of the population is struggling with conditioned hypereating. Our data indicate that those who exhibit conditioned hypereating are twice as likely to be obese as those who do not. Dana Small, a colleague at the John B. Pierce Laboratory and Yale University, worked with me to collect concrete evidence about the biological mechanisms driving conditioned hypereating. We studied the issue from 2 angles: how humans behave in the face of highly rewarding food, and how their brains actually respond. First, we further developed a scale that allowed us to distinguish high and low degrees of conditioned hypereating, based on the participants' responses to 11 statements about eating behavior. These included, "When it comes to foods I love, I have no willpower," and "I have days when I can't seem to think about anything else but food." The behavioral tests confirmed that people who scored higher on the conditioned hypereating scale were more willing to work for food. So that she could study their response to cues, Small also asked the subjects to smell chocolate and then to taste a chocolate milkshake. Normally, a pleasing aroma becomes less pleasant over time as we habituate to it. Not so with conditioned hypereaters. People who scored higher on the scale of conditioned hypereating reported that the odor became more pleasant over time. Then we looked at what was happening in people's brains. The differences in the reward centers were striking. High-scoring individuals exhibited an enhanced level of neural activity as they responded to the cue of a chocolate odor. This is the anticipatory phase when reward is expected, and to the taste of a milkshake. This is the consumption phase. Especially interesting was the response in the amygdala. This area of the brain, which normally allows us to anticipate reward, was also activated among conditioned hypereaters while they were eating. The heightened amygdala response drives the whole circuit out of whack, said Small. This suggests that the act of eating, when we might expect cue-induced anticipation to lessen, instead stimulates this vulnerable population. It also offers physiological evidence of what is observable in the real world. Eating rewarding food can enhance the drive for more rewarding food. Remember those brain pathways that allow us to focus on our environment's most salient stimuli and avoid the wild animal, escape a burning home, or tend to a sick child? Those pathways have been captured by the highly stimulating foods that are now available everywhere. Based on these findings, an argument can be made that conditioned hypereating is a syndrome or a condition characterized by a cluster of symptoms. We also have reason to assert that conditioned hypereating is associated with body weight. Framing conditioned hypereating in those terms helps us to think about the common biological mechanisms at play among those who are affected and makes it easier to agree on a diagnosis. At the same time, it highlights the power of environmental exposure. In other contexts, such as infectious diseases and chemical toxins, we understand that environmental factors can be associated with a cluster of symptoms, but we have not yet recognized this quality about eating. That said, defining conditioned hypereating as a cluster of symptoms also has limits. Although many people exhibit the defining characteristics to at least some degree, we can't say they all have the same condition, although we suspect they may all be at risk. Before we can apply the label appropriately, we need to know more about the brain responses of people who cluster somewhere in the middle of the conditioned hypereating continuum. Meanwhile, we shouldn't consider these distinctive patterns of behavior abnormal or pathological. Rather, they are a psychological adaptation to the environment that occurs among certain susceptible individuals. As learned responses, driven by the motivational circuits of our brains, these patterns almost certainly contribute significantly to the exploding obesity epidemic.
Chapter 32. Tracing the Roots of Conditioned Hypereating.
Clues to the puzzle of conditioned hypereating extend back many decades. In recent years, the extraordinary advances we've made in neuroscience have given us the ability to examine old information in new ways. In the 1970s, Stanley Schachter, a Columbia University social psychologist, became convinced that overweight people did not respond appropriately to internal signals, such as hunger, satiety, or a need for fuel. Our knowledge about the brain's ability to focus on salient stimuli and the nature of the reward system was not available then. But Schachter hypothesized that overweight people ate in response to external cues rather than internal signals. His theory came to be known as externality. Schachter's cracker study, which compared the eating behaviors of thin and overweight subjects, pointed to ideas we did not fully grasp at the time. He first divided his participants into two groups, offering one all the sandwiches they wanted to eat and asking the other only to fill out a questionnaire about food. Then he gave everyone the same opportunity to sample five different types of crackers. Not surprisingly, the thin people who had already eaten the sandwiches ate fewer crackers than the thin people who had simply completed the questionnaire. But those who were overweight ate about the same number of crackers, whether or not they had eaten the sandwiches first. Schachter theorized that the sight of food was exerting more pull on the overweight population than any internal messages reporting an absence of hunger. A roast beef sandwich experiment produced similar results. Richard Nisbet, also then at Columbia, offered his study subjects varying amounts of food, either placing one sandwich on a table or loading it up with three full sandwiches. He also told both groups they could help themselves to more sandwiches from a nearby refrigerator. People who were overweight ate what they were given, but did not seek out more food. If they could see it, they ate it. Visual cues took on preeminent importance. Those who were thin were more consistent in their eating patterns. They ate about a sandwich and a half, regardless of how much food was presented to them and whether or not they had to make trips to the refrigerator for more. Such studies helped establish externality as the dominant theory of weight gain for more than a decade. Through the 1970s, most textbooks offered it as the primary explanation for the eating behavior of the overweight. Then Judith Rodin, then at Yale University's Department of Psychology, who once worked closely with Schachter to develop the externality theory, raised questions about its validity. Externality was too simplistic, she wrote in a seminal article in American Psychologist in April 1981. Convinced the theory didn't hold up to closer scrutiny, Rodin pointed out that other researchers saw significant differences in how people in every weight category responded to external stimuli. Particularly confounding was the fact that some thin people also ate a lot more when they saw food or smelled it. Rodin's criticism gained traction, and the emphasis of weight research shifted away from the influence of external cues and toward the concept of restraint, which attributes overeating to dieting. Restraint theory says that people restrict their eating in order to lose weight, but they're unable to maintain that discipline indefinitely. Eventually, they lose control, overeat, and gain back the lost pounds. In time, cracks also appeared in the notion that restraint theory could offer a full explanation for weight gain, and researchers have recently come to regret having prematurely cast aside the theory of externality. Decades ago, Schachter and Rodin each set out to find a single mechanism that distinguished people who are overweight from those who are not. And they both demonstrated something important without fully understanding the implications. The externality theory recognized the power of cues. We now understand that's because they amplify the rewarding aspects of highly palatable food. Restraint theorists saw, accurately, the risks of deprivation, which we have come to realize increases the drive for reward. Based on what we have learned in more recent years, externality and restraint are two different manifestations of one thing, conditioned hypereating.
Chapter 33, Nature or Nurture?
A fundamental question about conditioned hypereating is whether it will turn out to be genetic or environmental in origin. Is it passed down from one generation to the next, inherited in much the same way that we inherit blue eyes or short stature? Or does it reflect patterns of eating acquired at home and at school, with friends and in the workplace, in response to broad trends promoted by the food industry? We don't yet have the definite answer, but we do have clues. Miles Faith of the Center for Weight and Eating Disorders at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine is an expert on the genetic basis of childhood eating behavior and obesity. Faith measured the tendency of children to eat in the absence of hunger. In one study, he allowed a group of 5-year-olds to eat as much dinner as they wanted until they reported feeling full and stopped voluntarily. Following dinner, these children were offered snack foods for a period of 10 minutes. Both the main meal and the snacks were the kinds of highly palatable foods that drive overeating. Faith also collected data about maternal weight as part of this study because 50 years of research has clearly established that a mother's weight is one of the best predictors of the weight of her child. Based on the pre-pregnancy weights of their mothers, Faith classified 5-year-olds as at high risk or low risk for obesity. Boys at high risk were more likely to reach for the snacks, even though a few minutes earlier they'd said they were full. The high-risk boys ate twice the calories the low-risk boys did. Faith did not find the same effect in girls. Something about our families, either the genes we inherit or the environment we share, seems to promote overeating behavior. But Faith wasn't willing to speculate on which had the greater effect. We know it's familial, but we cannot separate out genes from environment, he said. Digging more deeply into the available data, I looked at two studies involving twins, a population often favored by researchers trying to determine the relative contributions of genes and the environment. In one study, Swedish researchers found a great importance of genetic factors in the eating behavior of a large, unselected population of young adult male twins. Even so, inheritance was not the dominant influence. They estimated that genetics contributed to a bit less than half of an individual's total tendency to eat in an uncontrolled manner. In the other twins study, researchers reached the same conclusion. Cynthia Bulick, an expert in eating disorders at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and one of the study's authors, called the loss of control over eating a moderately heritable behavior trait. Somewhat higher estimates can be found elsewhere in the research literature. Eating in the absence of hunger is under substantial genetic control, concluded the authors of still another study. They estimate the heritability of eating without hunger at 51%, meaning that genetics accounts for 51% of an individual's total proclivity for the behavior. But other studies have cast uncertainty on all these findings. For example, one analysis of questionnaires completed by twins suggested that loss of control was not, in fact, a heritable trait, even though it was correlated with weight. Another study estimated heritability of disinhibited eating patterns at about 17%, but also found a significant correlation between spouses, which suggests that disinhibition may reflect what we do at home rather than what's in our genes. Currently available research, then, is inconclusive. Certainly, there are big differences in how individuals respond to external stimuli. Some of us are more impulsive, while others are better at avoidance behavior. Most studies do suggest that genes play some part in eating behavior, but also insist on the role played by environmental factors. The argument is only about which influence is predominant. My sense is that eating behavior itself may not be genetically determined, but how we respond to stimuli probably is, at least to some degree. One thing is certain. To whatever extent genes put us at risk for conditioned hypereating, they are able to express themselves only in the presence of highly rewarding foods. You have environmental factors that basically release the underlying genetic susceptibility, said Cynthia Bulick. A genetic predisposition has evolved over time in humans and animals, but a conducive environment is necessary to trigger hypereating. That's exactly what we have today.
Chapter 34. Warning Signs in Children.
To understand when conditioned hypereating takes the brain hostage, it's useful to consider the age when we first see indications of reward-driven eating. The process seems to begin in early childhood, and it now appears to be developing among younger and younger children. We have long thought that infants and preschool children intrinsically adjust their food consumption over a period of a day to take in a consistent number of calories. This is known as compensation, and a body of research attests to it. Give a preschooler food that is more energy dense than usual, that is, one with more calories in the same volume of food, and the child will compensate by subsequently eating less of other foods. This is part of the body's innate drive for homeostasis. But that self-regulatory system is changing. Susan Johnson, who directs the Children's Eating Laboratory at the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center, said that research has evidenced a population-wide shift over time. She told me that in the 1980s, children ages 2 to 4 were compensating for about 90% of any extra calories added to their diet. By the 1990s, they were compensating for only about 45% of those added calories. In her own studies, Johnson sees 3- and 4-year-olds who are able to pack in very large meals, sometimes consuming as much as 800 calories in one sitting. They just keep asking for more. "I did not see this kind of behavior in the past," she commented. 15 years ago, I would have said with great confidence that preschoolers compensate. But in the studies we've been doing of late, I see an incredible amount of dysregulatory behavior." Johnson has also examined a slightly older population, children ages 5 to 12. Her study compared the impact of drinking two different fruit-flavored beverages that tasted similar but had different calorie content on how much children ate at a subsequent meal. Those who ate less after drinking the high-calorie beverage compared with what they ate after drinking the low-calorie beverage were said to have compensated. Johnson found that school-aged children compensate to some degree, but not fully, and their capacity to compensate declined with age, year after year, especially among girls. The older they got, the less they compensated. For example, after drinking a high-calorie beverage, 5-year-old girls reduced their consumption of other foods to compensate for about 80% of the extra calories. That meant they were still taking in 20% more calories than those who drank the low-calorie beverage. By age 8, the girls were compensating only for 60% of the extra calories in the high-calorie beverage, and by 11, that figure hovered at around 30%. Loss of control, one of the defining characteristics of conditioned hypereating, seems to be a growing trend even among youngsters. I'm sensing a newer kind of disinhibition in children in some of the portion size work we've been doing, said Johnson. I never saw children who ate and ate and ate until you finally had to cut them off and say, you're done. They are eating to excess now. Jennifer Fisher, an expert in pediatric nutrition at the Center for Obesity Research and Education at Temple University, has observed the same thing. On different lunchtime occasions, she served a group of children, ages 3 to 5, either an age-appropriate portion of macaroni and cheese or a portion that was about double that size. Both meals were accompanied by milk, applesauce, carrots, and sugar cookies. Some of the children who were served the double portion of mac and cheese ate a lot more of it than others, but on average this group consumed about 25% more mac and cheese calories than those given the smaller portion. The children partially compensated by eating less of the accompanying foods, but they still ate a total of 15% more calories during the meal. Large entree portions may constitute an obesogenic environmental influence for preschool-aged children by producing excessive intake at meals, concluded the authors. In other words, when they were served more, they ate more. In a follow-up study with the same population, Fisher fed everyone an age-appropriate portion of macaroni and cheese and then offered them a number of toys and a large tray with generous portions of 10 snack foods, including popcorn, potato chips, nuts, pretzels, cookies, candy, and ice cream. Although the children had said they were no longer hungry, they were allowed to eat whatever they wanted for 10 minutes before researchers measured how many calories they'd consumed. Those who ate more of the snacks turned out to be the same ones who had eaten more when they were served double portions of macaroni and cheese in the earlier study.